John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, August 9, 2010. Israeli military has a shortage of Arabic translators, and a Palestinian farmer reclaimed some of his land from settlers. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. The lack of translators accessible to the army is preventing investigations by the military police and the Israeli forces from receiving testimony of abuses from Palestinians about Israeli soldiers. According to a report from the rights group Yeshdin, the group documented how many Palestinians go out of their way to attend pre-scheduled meetings with police investigators, only to have the meeting scrapped because of a lack of a suitable interpreter. Yeshdin emphasized that those wishing to give testimony set up a time to meet with the investigators, and then that to make the trip, they had to take the day off work, endure all the checkpoints to get to a meeting, only to be told that the meeting cannot continue due to the lack of an adequate translator. The occupying force is obliged to provide security for residents of the West Bank. The army has said it is only experiencing a temporary shortage of qualified persons. Around Bethlehem, a farmer with the help of the Palestinian Agricultural Relief Committee reclaimed land which had been inside of an illegal Israeli settlement. Imad Ashar of Hussein Village had his lands annexed 10 years ago by the Israeli military base near Bitar Elit settlement. The farmer was able to get back all 48 dunams of land recently, which had been behind the barbed wire fences of the settlement. The Agricultural Relief Committee determined that there was no legal basis for keeping the farmer from his land, only claims of security. At a cost of $1,000 per dunam, six families have gotten their lands returned to them. Park covered 75% of the costs. The farmers still endure harassment from settlers. In the Negev, the Israeli authorities destroyed three more houses on Monday. The demolitions come at a stressful time with the record heat and the coming of Ramadan. These latest demolitions come not long after Israel destroyed an entire village in the Negev because they had not recognized it as official. The people of Gaza face even more electricity blackouts as a fuel shortage becomes exaggerated. Power shut off Saturday and will only restart for about a day and a half unless more fuel is allowed into the Gaza Strip. There is an ongoing disagreement between the governments in Gaza and the West Bank over payments for that fuel. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. You have been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center. For constant update, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Brian Ennis.
Afghanistan yesterday. NATO is reporting the death of an occupation soldier from an IED attack in an undisclosed area in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, Sunday. The Danish military is reporting the deaths of two Danish occupation soldiers in a roadside bombing in Helmand Province. Three more soldiers were wounded. Afghanistan, Sunday. NATO is reporting the death of an occupation soldier from an IED attack in an undisclosed area in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, Saturday. Two U.S. Marines were killed when a prisoner grabbed a rifle and opened fire. The prisoner was also killed while fighting his way to freedom. Afghanistan, Saturday. NATO is reporting the death of an occupation soldier from an IED attack in an undisclosed area in southern Afghanistan on Saturday, the 7th of August. Afghanistan, last week, 8 foreign aid workers, 6 of them American, were killed when the Taliban ambushed their vehicles. The Taliban says they were killed for trying to convert people to Christianity and for spying for the U.S. Two Afghan pastors were released. Afghanistan, Thursday. Another NATO helicopter was shot down. The Taliban claiming to have used a rocket to bring it down, as described in the WikiLeaks reports. No casualties reported. Afghanistan, 5th of August. NATO aircraft bombed a funeral in Kogani District, Nangarhar Province, eastern Afghanistan. A vehicle carrying a coffin and a dead man's relative was bombed. 11 civilians, including women and children, were killed. Babil Province, Iraq, Saturday. The U.S. military is reporting the death of a United States Division South soldier from an unreported combat-related cause. This is on the same day the U.S. formally turned over combat duties to the occupation regime in Baghdad. Supposedly, all U.S. combat troops will be gone by the end of the month, while all insurgent groups are staying. This means they have won and the U.S. has lost. Meanwhile, the fighting goes on. Basra, Iraq, Saturday. A coordinated series of two car bombs and a bomb on a power generator killed at least 43 people, with 185 reported wounded. The Basra police chief tried to blame the deaths on a malfunctioning power generator's explosion, but other reports say three bombs exploded, two of them car bombs. Baghdad, Sunday. A suicide car bomber hit a police patrol west of Baghdad, killing 8 people. Most of the people killed were standing in a post office line trying to collect their welfare checks. Mr. Barack Obama, does this sound like the U.S. has been successful in stabilizing Iraq? Does this sound like a useful battle plan for Afghanistan? Now is the time to pull the plug on all these wars. Bring all the troops home today.
And no amount of money you could give me, honey, couldn't pay me. Ain't going back again.
Of August, anti-war protesters showed up at Quantico Marine Base demanding that Bradley Manning, the person accused of sending the documents to WikiLeaks that proved the U.S. is losing the Afghan war, be released, not prosecuted.
Free Bradley Manning! Free Bradley Manning! Free Bradley Manning! Free Bradley Manning! Free Bradley Manning!
My name is Matt. I served in Iraq in 2004 as an intel analyst. And as a former analyst, I stand with Bradley Manning today. Silence is betrayal.
That's right.
Silence is betrayal. The truth of these wars we all know, and some have seen. And Bradley Manning was courageous enough, brave enough, to stand against the military machine and release these things. Possibly. He's been accused, not convicted. If this is true, I admire his courage and strength.
Amen.
It is not criminal to tell the truth. It is not criminal to speak out against the military machine. It is criminal to stay silent. In the face of something immoral, in the face of injustice, while there is injustice, there will never be peace. And it is unjust to jail someone for speaking the truth, for bringing to the American consciousness what we all know to be true. And that these wars are immoral, they're illegal, and they're unjust. And it's time to end them. It's time to bring our troops home. It's time to bring our soldiers home. Marines, Navy, everyone, bring them back. Stand with the Afghan people. Support the Afghan people. But not militarily. It's time to end these wars. I hope that we can all recognize that Bradley Manning is a hero. And that he deserves to be freed. And to be heard. Let his voice be heard, not the voices of many people for or against him, but let him tell his story, why he may or may not have done what he has done. So that's all I have to say.
All right. Manning is our youth. Give him power to speak the truth. Bradley Manning is our youth. Give him power to speak the truth. Bradley Manning is our youth. Give him power to speak the truth.
Wars need secrets. Illegal wars keep illegal secrets. These aren't the only secrets. These are only secrets to people in this country. People in Afghanistan, they know this. People in Iraq, they know this. They don't need us to release documents telling them what's happening in their countries. The Taliban knows this. The people know this. The resistance forces, the anti-resistance forces. This isn't news. Ironically, the Obama administration is kind of trying to have it both ways. On the one hand, saying, there's nothing new here. Yeah, well, that's certainly true. But there's blood on their hands if they release it. Really? You want to really try and have it both ways?
Yep.
This is an illegal war. The secrets are illegal. Releasing secrets is the first step. This isn't just about Bradley Manning. This is about illegal wars with illegally held secrets. We should remember it was the Pentagon. It wasn't a whistleblower. It was the Pentagon who made their own decision about the decision to escalate in Afghanistan more than a year ago, before President Obama announced it. They didn't seem to think that was inappropriate. We have a long history of whistleblowers in this country, and they have changed history. They come out of movements, and they strengthen movements. When Pentagon Papers 2.0 was released, what's known as the WikiLeaks documents, this absolutely reflected that history.
To say that we are the making the lives better. It's a lie to say that we are protecting women. Keep in mind one thing. When those against our position who want to continue the war say, well, don't we have to stay to protect the women? Keep in mind one thing, that the vast majority of women who die too early in Afghanistan today don't die in a Taliban attack. They die in childbirth. Because Afghanistan is the second worst country in the world for a woman to give birth and survive. One out of every six women in Afghanistan dies in childbirth. Now, in the year 2000, when the Taliban was in control, how many women do you think died in childbirth? Exactly the same. One out of six. We have done nothing for the women of Afghanistan except make their lives worse. That's the answer to those who say we need to maintain a military occupation. We need this information not because it's new, but because it's irrefutable. Because it's exactly what the president said it was, nothing new.
but it changes how we understand these wars. That's why we need whistleblowers. That's why secrets kill. Wars need secrets. Democracy needs whistleblowers. Thank you.
Transparency is not a crime. War criminals do the crime. Transparency is not a crime. War criminals do the crime.
In one of the largest unauthorized releases of classified military files since the Vietnam War era Pentagon Papers in 1971, the website WikiLeaks published some 91,000 documents of Pentagon field reports related to the war in Afghanistan. The documents, totaling over 200,000 pages, covers the period from January 2004 to December 2009, spanning the last 5 years of the Bush presidency and the first year of the Obama administration. The Archive of Military Logs reveals a grim picture of a failing war that polls find is increasingly unpopular among a majority of Americans. The documents describe unreported incidents of U.S. and NATO forces killing of Afghan civilians, expansion of a CIA assassination program targeting suspected Taliban and Al-Qaeda leaders, the Taliban's acquisition of ground-to-air heat-seeking missiles, and the use of Predator and Reaper remote-controlled drones piloted from a U.S. base in Nevada. Among the most publicized information from the classified documents in the U.S. were reports that Pakistan's military intelligence agency, the ISI, continues to actively support and strategize the war with the Taliban leadership. The White House and Pentagon have condemned the release of the documents, as some commentators and politicians call for the prosecution of those who leaked the files and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, an Australian citizen. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Tom Engelhardt, creator of the Nation Institute's TomDispatch.com website and co-founder of the American Empire Project. He assesses the importance of the WikiLeaks documents and their possible effect on U.S.-Afghan war policy.
Well, I'll tell you, the major point to me is not what's in the documents. It's true that if you had been reading, for instance, TomDispatch.com or other places like it, you wouldn't be surprised by most of what's there. I mean, the news is, you know, but the real story here isn't specifically what's in the documents, but that for the second time in a month, the first time being General McChrystal's escapade with Rolling Stone, his firing, and the appointment of General Petraeus, a runaway story about Afghanistan has burst its way through onto the front pages of American papers and to the top of the news. This has really been, the Afghan war has been the war that time more or less forgot, in the United States anyway. And I think that's probably the biggest news. And with it goes, I mean, it's true that if you were reading Tom Dispatch, you probably knew a lot of this. But generally, if you were an American out there just reading whatever was in the mainstream, you had to get pretty deep into your newspaper most of the time to find anything about this stuff. So I think this is news, and I think the basic message of these documents, and only about 75,000 have been released so far. I think the Times, the Guardian, and Der Spiegel got to look at the full 91 or 92,000, but there are about 15,000 that WikiLeaks hasn't even released yet. I think the real message is pretty blunt, which is Afghanistan grim, Afghan war going badly. I mean, it's not complicated at some level, and in fact, what these documents describe is a war that at every level, 9 years later almost, is going disastrously for the United States by the standards of the people who are fighting it.
The Obama administration, responding to these leaked documents, basically said, well, this covered a period of time, 6 years in the Afghan war, that extended from 2004 under President Bush to December 2009, when Barack Obama launched his new surge, his 30,000 troop surge in Afghanistan, and what they claim is a change policy there. Is there any reason to believe that the documents here paint a picture that's outdated?
Well, I would say this is disingenuous because, first of all, the Pentagon Papers, which this is often compared to, although it's a complicated analogy to make, by the time they were released during the Vietnam War, what was in them was 3 years old. I mean, these documents end in December 2009. This is a little less than a year after Obama came into power. In that same December, he had already surged in March of 2009. He doubled down again that very December. So I would say that the last of them actually reflect the Obama world. I mean, I mean, if anything, under Obama, things have gotten worse, not better. I mean, in other words, it's true that this is, quote, old news, but the new news, if you're dealing with most of these subjects, for instance, the Taliban surge, because we surged, but the Taliban surge too. The Taliban surge, worse in 2010 than in 2009. The Afghan army, corruption, you know, inadequacy, numbers not what they say they are, et cetera, et cetera. Same in 2010 as 2009. I mean, I think in essence, I mean, what they're claiming is simply that they are that their counterinsurgency program is a new program, although they were doing that in 2009 too. The people who are saying this is old news, other than the administration itself, were people for whom until recently the Afghan war was no news. So, you know, the first response was, well, old news, nothing new here, out of date anyway. Now, the newest one is the administration, particularly Secretary of Defense Gates and Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Mullen, have grabbed this story, and they finally turned to the issue of blood. But in this case, the blood is not the blood that's on American hands. It's the prospective blood that's going to be on the hands of Julian Assange, the fellow who's the founder of WikiLeaks, because some of these documents that he released had the names of Afghan informers in them, and they may be killed.
Tom, do you think that the release of these documents will in any way affect the course of the war, how the Pentagon's going to fight it, and how the Obama White House is going to respond?
I think that the two areas where it's likely to have some actual effect, one is at home, where any time that the war comes more or less out of the closet, where it comes out of hiding, and it ends up front and center, it makes people feel less good about it here. So that's one place. The second place is Pakistan, where, you know, there is this story. The story that gained traction here is the Pakistanis are dealing with us, but they're double-timing because they're also running the Taliban. And again, well, that information in these documents came from, basically came up from Afghan intelligence, which at least The Guardian felt didn't indicate reliable information. Certainly people have been talking for years about the fact that the Pakistani intelligence, ISI, its intelligence agency, had a relationship to the Taliban and possibly a very close one. And the release of these documents forces the Obama administration potentially to put even more pressure on the Pakistanis. And I don't think that's going to play out well at all in Pakistan, where we're looked on as largely by public opinion already as an enemy state. So I think that it is creating certain problems, yes.
That was Tom Engelhart, creator of the Nation Institute's TomDispatch.com website. His most recent book is titled The American Way of War, How Bush's Wars Became Obama's.
Suppose Army recruiting ads had to have side effect warnings like drug advertisements on TV do.
The United States Army may not be right for every patient. Side effects can include distress, disillusionment, bitter resentment, isolation, traumatic and post-traumatic stress, sociopathic behavior, uncontrollable sobbing, uncontrollable violence, prosecutions for war crimes, prosecutions for domestic crimes, loss of contact with loved ones, loss of ability to love, brain injuries, blindness, depleted uranium poisoning, flashbacks, horror of death, horror of being away from death, loss of the use of limbs, loss of limbs, death, suicide, excruciating pain, the desire to feel excruciating pain, overwhelming rage and misery, loss of hearing, punishment by the Army for failure to obey illegal orders, punishment by courts of law or by enemy forces for obeying illegal orders, torture, humiliation, shame, dangerous habits of blind subservience, or the wasting of what could have been the best years of your life. If you experience any of these symptoms, deal with it, sucker. You already signed your name on the dotted line.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQT Radio at hushmail.com. WSQT Radio at hushmail.com.
For the past 64 years, the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia, has been graduating assassins, dictators, and death squad leaders to do the dirty work of the elite in Latin America. The taxpayer-funded SOA has left a trail of violence and suffering in every country where its graduates have returned. Hundreds of thousands of Latin Americans have been tortured, raped, assassinated, disappeared, displaced, and massacred by those trained at the SOA. Enough is enough. Every year, thousands gather in Georgia to protest U.S. military involvement in Latin America. Join us at the gates of the SOA this November to honor the victims, celebrate the resistance, and pressure our government to shut down the school once and for all. From November 18th to 21st, we will have live concerts, speakers from around the world, street theater, workshops, and more. For more information on how you can stand with us to end the injustice, visit SOAW.org or call 202-234-3440.
On the 29th of July, at a Ward 1 Candidates Forum held by a number of D.C. progressive organizations in the True Redeemer Building, D.C.'s Ward 1 Council Member Jim Graham showed up late, insulting the groups that put on the Candidates Forum by doing so. Once Jim Graham arrived, his speeches were long on blowing his own horn, but often concealed the extent of his own deal-making with developers at the expense of the people.
Question number 8. Number of homeless families in D.C. continues to grow, and families are overcrowded at the D.C. General Shelter.
Yeah, thanks to the closure of Franklin Shelter in downtown D.C.
Many other families are on a wait list for service or are living on Mr. Graham. And what are your plans for a shelter in your one if the cost of closes? Please answer this question.
Thank you very much for this question. You know, the fact of the matter is that low barrier shelters, such as at La Casa, you know, are very important, but they can't be the whole answer.
Back in 2004, Councilmember Jim Graham cast a deciding vote to close Randall Shelter so the building could be given to the Corcoran Gallery of Art. This shelter was also deemed too close to the baseball stadium. This was a 3-2 vote in committee, and Jim Graham was the undecided vote until he voted with the developers to close Randall Shelter.
Because the fact of the matter is we've got to move people into single-room occupancies, which is known as SROs. I support the mayor's efforts to do that, which is happening right now at La Casa. I support the efforts which will also give people their own apartments, which happened in D.C. Village, where D.C. Village was an absolute nightmare. Until we stepped in and we said, we want you to have your own apartments. We don't want this kind of family, low barrier shelter.
There's just one problem with Finney's Housing First plan, and that is that a lot of people who were thrown out of Franklin Shelter when it closed and given an apartments promptly lost those apartments and are now back on the street.
We're still going to need low barrier shelters, and for that reason, I support the move of Central Union Mission to the Gale School at 65 Massachusetts Avenue. I worked hard to have that happen. It's finally happening. They're not going to 3512 Georgia.
And now one of Mr. Graham's primary opponents responds.
There was no space in any of the family shelters that were using DC General as a spot to house families. It should be a black letter that we're wearing on our vest, because that's the hypothermia center. So if we continue with double-digit unemployment into the winter, and we have a winter that was like last year, where do we send people who are suffering from hypothermia living physically on the streets? We have no space. So the question that I want, and I'm completely for moving people into long-term goals, trying to get them into apartments, trying to get them into home ownership, trying to like create new subsidies to create more public housing. But the question I have is, all of these programs that are looking to the future, why did we close the Randolph School? Why would we close a shelter at a time that we are critically in need of bed space for families, for women, for children, for fathers, who are out actively looking for jobs every day, and they're forced to live in the hypothermia center at DC General? This is our crisis at this time, and we need to find something immediately to do that. So I would suggest that any of these schools that we have that are not being, we need to retrofit them specifically right now for families while we have this double
degree. Like Franklin?
Kim Graham didn't give straight answers to somebody asking him about libraries either.
What did Mr. Graham have to say about the library situation?
Well, he pulls out normal stuff that he's had umpteen number of meetings. But unfortunately, he never points out the fact that even his compromise was thrown off the table by DCPL and DC Public Library, and that the fact that these meetings, you can have 1,000 meetings, but if the community's voice isn't listened to, what's the point of them?
So Mr. Graham, basically, his response is say, oh, I had this meeting and I had that meeting?
Right. And he's claiming that the ramp is ADA compliant. We don't know how they changed the plans. Last, they were not ADA compliant, so somehow he has inside knowledge. And he also pointed out that the chief made some fire report claiming that this this project is okay, but it's clearly going to block access off of Lamont Street, which is about access to about 1,000 people, and one of the buildings in Deauville burned dead into the ground.
Yeah, landlord arson.
Right, and the fire department couldn't get back there readily. This will make it worse. The fire department has never had a discussion with any of these surrounding neighbors in 2.5 years.
This is convenient for those who want to burn out the rest of the community up there, isn't it?
It does make it more convenient. I hate to say that. And it's sad because it's just not necessary. This is an opportunity to increase access. Instead, we're seeing a decrease for seniors and residents with disabilities, and we're seeing a decrease for the safety of the residents living around the library.
Keep it above, Jim Graham! Woo! I'll buy my percentage too. I'm giving people $100 to put yard signs in their yard.
Is your SUV running low on gas? Is your wallet been running on fumes lately? Well, this is Behind Pollution, offering blowout prices on regular, plus, and premium at every BP Behind Pollution gas station, where you can get a gusher of savings filling up that Ford Excursion or that Hummer. And never mind our blown out oil well at Macondo in the Gulf of Mexico. Never mind all those oiled pelicans. And never mind this burning hot summer of global warming. Never mind the voices that tell you to boycott BP for the horrific things Behind Pollution has done in the Gulf of Mexico. Just keep filling up that SUV. Just keep enjoying that gusher of savings the blowout prices at BP gas stations are bringing you. After all, you never liked seafood much anyway. After 3 months of BP's oil spewing into the Gulf of Mexico, in the middle of the hottest July ever recorded in D.C., the Washington Post is reporting that SUVs in Glover Park had their tires flattened. On Thursday night, the 22nd of July, a number of SUVs in Glover Park received flat tires. Even the head of the Glover Park Citizens Association had her tires flattened. Police are speculating that the damage was ecologically motivated, according to the Washington Post. Do elves walk among us even today, striking out against global warming and BP's oil spill in Glover Park? On the same night, 7 or 8 vehicles in Loudoun County, Virginia, had their windows smashed. The cops are saying that this is less likely to be the work of pro-Earth gorillas. Just imagine this. You just spent $100,000 buying a like-new Hummer. You said, to hell with sharing the road and to hell with Earth. One morning, you wake up, 4 flat tires, all your windows broken, and the 3 magic letters ELF keyed into your paint. Your insurance says, FBI calls ELF terrorism, and we don't cover terrorism. Do elves of the ELF walk among us here in D.C.? The Washington Post and area law enforcement don't know, but with BP's oil spewing for so long,
this summer's record heat, there may be a hell of a lot of people who don't like seeing selfish urban SUV drivers right now. I have a feeling the police face yet another fruitless investigation, uselessly chasing elves. On the 27th of July, the Animal Liberation Front brought the flames of liberation to Yapelto's fur farm in Astoria, Oregon. Owner Henry Pelto woke up to the sound of explosions in the night, finding structures and farm equipment in flames in both the front and rear of the property. Since ALF never burns buildings containing the living, the fur farmer's home was spared, only his chances to keep murdering animals for the skins off their backs went up in flames. The owner is now claiming that he shut the fur farm down in December 2009 after two prior visits from the Animal Liberation Front. He could well be lying, as this information has not been heard before by animal rights activists. That's right. No more lies, blood and fire. Fire has been visited upon those who have spilled so much blood. Assuming the farm is shut down for good now, this is the second fur farm in Oregon the ALF has been able to shut down by force. The SNN fur farm in Scio, Oregon was found to be empty in a summer 2009 investigation as part of the Fur Farm Intelligence Project. That farm was raided by the ALF in September 2008. Astoria is the largest mink farming town in Oregon, home to not five known mink farms and another possible one that is unconfirmed. Of course, if animal rights insurgents keep taking these fur farms out, that could soon change.
No more nights, blood and fire. No more nights, no blood and fire. Oh, no more nights. Oh, no more nights.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Well, DNA, it's natural. It's the building block of life. And when the good Lord put it together, you know, I think he did it upright. He made lots of different organisms, a complex web of life. Each one depended on another, and so the circle it closed up tight. But then along came a man and a microscope, and he separated the genes. And when he put them all back together, he made lots of strange, unnatural things. And now food crops grow on the ocean floor, cows that grow on trees. Now the ranchers gaze while their oysters graze on grass that depends on a hormone spray in our genetically modified world.
The Democratic Republic of the Congo is in the midst of a new gold rush, with more than $1 billion worth being mined each year, boosting the profits of Western mining companies that are increasingly active in the Central African country. Meanwhile, Congo's millions of poor continue to survive by getting only a tiny share of the gold profits. According to Mother Jones magazine, the gold mines became the prized possessions of longtime dictator Mobutu Sese Seko, who ruled the Congo with Western assistance for over 30 years. During that era, Mobutu accumulated a reported personal fortune of $4 billion. He kept tight control over the mines in northeast Congo, which finally stopped producing gold due to massive corruption. The gold mines were a valuable commodity to rival militia factions in the recent civil war, which began in 1998. With the aid of the United Nations peacekeepers, the mines are again in control of the Congolese government. With the relative quiet, Western mining companies are eager to restart operations. In the gold-rich town of Mungwala, the world's third-largest gold mining giant, AngloGold Ashanti, is preparing to extract 2.5 million ounces of gold, worth over $3 billion at current prices. The Washington Post reports that the Obama administration is seeking to give the FBI new powers to obtain the internet activity records of individuals without a court order. The White House is attempting to insert four words, electronic communications transactional records, into the list of items the FBI can seek without a judicial order. Information requested could include the internet address an individual uses to send email, the time and date of an email, and an individual's browser's history. Michelle Richardson of the American Civil Liberties Union called the Obama proposal incredibly bold given the amount of electronic data the government is already getting. From 2003 to 2006, the Justice Department issued over 192,000 national security letters, which don't require a court order, according to an Inspector General report during the Bush administration. Audits found the FBI had possibly violated its own agency regulations by issuing national security letters without justification. Greg Nogheim of the Center for Democracy and Technology warned that the expanded use of national security letters exposes associational information protected by the First Amendment.
After the 1991 U.S. coalition war against Saddam Hussein's Iraq, following his invasion of neighboring Kuwait, Washington succeeded in imposing a severe economic embargo against Iraq, administered by the UN, that remained in effect until President Bush's 2003 invasion and overthrow of Hussein's regime. By many accounts, the post-Persian Gulf War sanctions against Iraq resulted in a humanitarian catastrophe, where basic services such as health care, water treatment, agriculture, and education were crippled. As Fairfield University professor of philosophy Joy Gordon recounts in her new book, Invisible War, the U.S. and Iraq Sanctions, between 670,000 and 880,000 Iraqi children under the age of 5 died as a result of the sanctions. Gordon maintains that the suffering borne by the Iraqi people under the U.N. sanctions, mostly driven by American policy, served to strengthen, not weaken, Saddam's hold on power. Now, with growing concern within the U.N. Security Council that Iran is engaged in a covert nuclear weapons program, the U.S. is pushing for ever harsher sanctions against the Islamic Republic. President Obama has proclaimed that the smart sanctions he's advocating against Iran will avoid indiscriminately harming the innocent. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Professor Gordon, who explains why she believes economic sanctions targeting nations for their behavior, whatever the label, are ineffective at motivating change and result in harm to innocent civilians.
You know, I think we're used to thinking of sanctions as sort of this very attractive middle route that it seems more than, you know, just words of diplomacy, and it seems less violent than military intervention. And the truth is, it doesn't have any of the kinds of costs of military intervention. It doesn't have the political risks or the cost to your own military forces. And it does have more clout than diplomacy in one particular regard, which has to do with posturing for your own constituency. So sanctions have always been attractive because it seems like you're doing something, but you're not doing something that's going to put you as a political leader at risk. The problem is that sanctions are pretty much always indiscriminate, and they're pretty much always ineffective. If by effective, what you mean is getting the target state to do what you're telling it you want to do, whether it's has to do with aggression or human rights violations. The research on sanctions shows that in the 20th century, out of 120 instances of sanctions being imposed, in about 3% of the cases, is it the case that the target state actually does what you've demanded it do as a response to the sanctions. So they just sort of don't work by that kind of a measure. And what they also are is almost without exception overbroad and indiscriminate. If you contract the economy, who's hurt? Well, it's the poor. It's the ones who are most vulnerable, the ones who are most marginal, infants, young children, the elderly, the sick, women, and the poor are the ones who are hurt most when, for example, the quality of potable water goes down. Who is hurt least? Well, it's the leadership. It's the political and military and economic elite, the ones that are responsible for the decisions that you think are wrong in the first place.
Now, when we hear about Iran and the so-called smart sanctions, is this, I guess that's opposed to the dumb sanctions or the overbroad and, just widespread indiscriminate sanctions you just described. Is there any difference in what the United Nations, spearheaded by the Obama administration, is trying to do with these new sanctions imposed against Iran?
Well, the notion of smart sanctions got formulated in the late 1990s, really in response to the situation of Iraq, which was unprecedented. During the Cold War, sanctions never were comprehensive, and they never had an enormous humanitarian impact, because if the Soviets sanctioned someone, they could trade with the U.S., and if the U.S. sanctioned someone, they could trade with the Soviets. So the Iraq sanctions come along, and they are comprehensive, because they're imposed by the Security Council under Chapter 7 of the Charter. Literally, every nation in the world is obligated to enforce them. And because Iraq was so vulnerable, it was so dependent on imports and exports, then the sanctions, in combination with the massive bombing strikes of 1991, were really devastating. Child mortality increased by 250%. Malnutrition was off the charts. Every major system in the country collapsed. Health, education, electricity, water treatment, everything. So in the mid to late 90s, people started, political scientists and ethicists and a broad range of people started saying, well, there's actually ethical problems with sanctions because they're so overbroad. Look at Iraq. Different proposals started emerging for this idea of targeted sanctions. So in the case of the U.S., the U.S. says, we have targeted sanctions on Iran. We are targeting their gas and oil industries. Well, Iran's gas and oil industries account for more than a quarter of its economy. And as you can imagine in the U.S., if a quarter of our economy took a hit, that would not be targeted at all. That would affect all costs of goods, all transportation, heating fuel. If the U.S. were successful in undermining Iran's gas and oil industries. So there's this language of smart sanctions, but that's as good an example of an indiscriminate sanction as you can imagine. The UN sanctions are overbroad in a different way. They have lists. So if you look at these lists, you think, oh, well, these must be targeted sanctions because there's lists of here's the name of this company and the name of that individual. So I see that they're aiming at a very specific person or entity, except that some of the things on the list are the largest bank in Iran, and Iran's national shipping lines. So, in fact, if you succeeded at what the claim is, which is to compromise Iran's ability to engage in financial transfers in the global financial market, or succeeded in undermining Iran's ability to import and export goods because their shipping lines have been compromised, then of course those are indiscriminate. But to the extent the sanctions are effective on Iran, they will be indiscriminate as they've been implemented and designed, and they will hurt the wrong people, and they will not touch those responsible for whatever policies we're objecting to.
That was Joy Gordon, professor of philosophy at Fairfield University and author of the new book, Invisible War, The U.S. and Iraq Sanctions. Read her recent article, Lessons We Should Have Learned from the Iraqi Sanctions, online at foreignpolicy.com.